Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
It is. And we're joined on Fridays by Michael Harrison. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, Todd. How are you? I'm on a telephone.
How about that? It sounds, you know what? It sounds like you're on a telephone.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you can't even tell the difference. My voice is so good that it resonates with any type of technological device.
That was my second option.
Well, I assume everything is going well in your life and that you are on top of things.
Yeah, it's been a nice frantic week because of the storm and the power losses. The storm was a big surprise. You know, it was supposed to be a mellow storm. The governor told us on Tuesday afternoon as power started to go, oh, don't worry about it, not going to be a deal. And then it turned out to be a big freaking disaster.
Yeah, yeah. These storms can be very tricky. I am still down in Florida, and we were right at the point where the storm was heading toward the coast. So, you know, down here, the people are very sensitive about hurricanes or tropical storms that are about to become hurricanes. Mm-hmm. So all of the shutters went up and the plywood, and people were, you know, prepared. And I just had a feeling, looking at the trajectory of this thing, that it was just going to bypass us. I have to tell you, it was less fierce down here in Florida, where it was supposed to be strong, than your average afternoon summer thunderstorm. The rain was less, the wind was less. It just wasn't very strong. So we felt as if we dodged a bullet. But then, watching as the thing went up, and as you know, I'm based up there. Talkers is there, my family is there, my friends are there.
Your life is here.
I got very concerned, and obviously watched it with a certain degree of horror. It really messed us up in terms of our business. We lost power at our headquarters for about 3 days, so we were operating, you know, around it. Some towns had no water. All kinds of things happened. So, you know, I'm glad that we're on the backside of it all the way around. You know, the earth can be a hostile place.
It certainly can be, and we are woefully unprepared for all kinds of reasons. On some level, I guess we have unreasonable expectations that we think that business as usual should always be able to go on no matter what. That nature has no say in that, and that obviously isn't the case. But we're also, I think, naive about our own management and how finely tuned that system of excellence is, because they haven't been required to do a lot in terms of taking care of us and making sure things work. It just seems to have worked out for the most part through the years.
We get by. We stumble from crisis to crisis. When I say we, I mean, you know, people, the human race. Mm-hmm. We always think it's the worst of times. We always think it's the most modern of times, and we always think that we're losing the wonderful things that make us human that we had before, and consider it to be a brave new world. If you study history, this has always been the case, with some minor exceptions. every generation thinks that the generation that follows them doesn't have the same values, doesn't have the same grip on reality. We think that we are the crown of creation, that we are at the absolute peak of human evolution, and that we have most of the mysteries of the universe solved. And this goes all the way back to the beginning of history. You can read things in books and scrolls and texts and things that you'd think they were written today, and they were written 3,000-4,000 years ago.
Is there any specific moment where you think you can point at humanity and say, oh, that's the point at which the pinnacle occurred, and that was nowhere near right now?
Well, I don't understand the question.
You're suggesting that, you know, Americans and humans in general assume that there is a continual move upwards in terms of the quality of who we are and how we manage our own lives and manage the planet, that we are a new and improved human race every day. And we all assume that's a straight line and that we're way smarter than humans have ever been. And you're suggesting, no, it's nonlinear, that there could be lots of other times when we were better than we are today. And I just thought maybe you had a particular point in mind.
What an interesting concept. I hadn't thought about it, but I would think now that you've, you know, tickled my brain, perhaps the Renaissance was a time when we came out of the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages, which was one of those setback periods. And we came into what was called the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Discovery, the arts, new ideas in government. I would say that that was probably a very exciting time to live in.
And, yeah, it must have been.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the 20th century was definitely something that, as we look back at it, we will be reevaluating it historically. You know, most of the people listening to this broadcast, and you and I, are immigrants from the 20th century here in the new land of the 21st century. But there are people 18, 19, 20 years old who are natives of this new country, and they see the world very differently. And I find it very interesting how we're already beginning to reevaluate a lot of the things about the 20th century that we thought were givens that are not. For example, this week was the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. Uh-huh. And I just know in my lifetime, the way we've talked about that event and the way we have considered it from a historical perspective has changed tremendously from decade to decade, from year to year, and from generation to generation. We're constantly reassessing, reevaluating, and relearning while hurtling forward into new technology and new issues about being human, being Americans, being whatever it is that we consider ourselves to be.
We're very into the physical world, and I think it's hard to look back at the Enlightenment, as enlightened as it might have been, and say that maybe they were more advanced than us when they didn't have indoor plumbing, when death rates were so much higher because of the lack of sanitation, and we're maybe all messed up in our fixation on the physical world as opposed to the spiritual intellectual.
We are definitely consumer oriented. And we are definitely materialistic. There's no question about that. But sometimes if you're too spiritual and you're too disengaged from the reality of the material world, you could also be a little freaky and a little bit out of phase with nature. I mean, we are living in the material world. The key is to find a balance between the spirits within us and the fact that we are biological machines, and this is where we are. So, you know, it's a conundrum. This challenges any ounce of wisdom that we as individuals might have, how to balance that. This is, you and I are not discovering this. This is an age-old problem of the material world versus the spiritual world. But going back in time, we even don't recognize how advanced some of the older societies were technologically. You look at some of the things that the Romans did in ancient Rome. They had running water, they had plumbing, they had aqueducts, they had buildings that were heated, they had heating systems.
How did they do
that? They would have a furnace down at the bottom. They would have piping. They would have all kinds of you know, architectural innovations.
And well, I want to see this Roman furnace. What is this, like a wood-burning steam generator?
I don't know
generator?
The exact details. I can't get into all the details. I only know it's peripheral way. But I do know that when these buildings were new, you know, we think when we look back at the ancient ruins, we look at the pyramids of Egypt. They look like old, you know, old cones. Back in their day, they were white and shiny and golden and bright. You could see them for miles glistening in the sun. When these societies, when ancient Greece, you know, the Parthenon and the Colosseum in Rome, when these were new buildings, they didn't look like ruins. They looked like modern buildings, and they were built to last. Many of the buildings today that we take as being modern skyscrapers and, you know, current architecture, they'll be gone in 20 years. Look at Shea Stadium in New York. Look at the Astrodome. These were the most modern things of all time, and they become white elephants in 25 years, 30 years. So there's a great hubris to us also in terms of thinking that somehow what we do today is more advanced, better, more long-lasting, and even more important than what ancients might have done. And then, of course, we don't know about all that missing history that goes before ancient times. You know, Homo sapiens, with the same brain size that we have now, have been on this planet for 100,000 years, and our history only goes back 5,000 years. Isn't it kind of presumptuous to think that maybe they were smart enough to do some of the things we've done many times and just have been wiped off the face of the earth by erosion and, you know, the sands of time? Who knows?
Yeah, it's fascinating. All right, you've raised some good things to think about. Michael Harrison, hang with us. It's Friday, so Michael's here from Talkers Magazine at talkers.com. Quick break. We'll talk more on WTIC. So I had never heard this, Michael Harrison, about ancient Romans having wealthy households having central heating. And it's fascinating what they did. They put the floor up on tiles so there would be airspace, and then they built a fire underneath it. And they actually sealed up the floor so that it could have hot, deadly smoke circulating under the living space and not kill everybody living inside. And they did it successfully.
They weren't stupid. And the aqueducts in Rome were, that was a wonder of the world. They used the gravity of the earth to transport water for miles and miles over very difficult terrain, keeping the pressure of the water moving toward the city from the outer-lying areas, based upon an ultimate gravity that kept it going down, even though at some places the water actually had to go up. You know, brilliant technology and engineering. I think the thing that marks our era from these other eras is the harnessing. I don't want to say the invention, because we didn't invent it, but the harnessing of electricity from nature itself gave us a chance to make an exponential leap forward in terms of our technology by electrifying things. But gravity, wind, the invention of the sailboat, the invention of the ship harnessing the wind to be able to set sail across the ocean and to have the sail set up in such a configuration that you could actually go against the very wind that's powering you. Anybody who's a sailor out there knows what I'm talking about. That's one of the hardest things to learn, how
yes,
to go
going
into
the
wind.
Yeah.
Yeah, and move into it and move forward. So there's all kinds of interesting things. We're very arrogant about our time in the history of, you know, the history of the human race. We're very arrogant about it. And you know, maybe it takes a storm or two or things of that nature to show how fragile we really are, and that we're not that different.
Not just fragile, but But unprepared, lacking the knowledge of what our ancestors did before there was electricity and central plumbing and central heating, how did they survive in extreme temperatures and all? And they knew how to do it, and we don't. So I think our arrogance would go away awfully quickly if we had to go a month or two living without our modern luxuries.
Mm-hmm. And when you lose something, you know the old Joni Mitchell song, doesn't always seem to go. You don't know what you got till it's gone. We tend to think there's a certain level of default as to what's natural, normal, and to which we're entitled. And then when it's gone, all of a sudden you're, whoa, maybe there's a great pleasure in sitting in front of a fire when you don't have electricity or heat. Maybe... You know, the meal that you went out and hunted and cooked and did for yourself might even taste better because of the accomplishment of doing that. You know, we don't always realize how simple things we take for granted would be great accomplishments if we had to do it without the aid of our support system, our infrastructure, our organizations, and our technology. It's good to think about these things. It puts things in perspective.
No, absolutely. You mentioned before changing attitudes towards our bombing of Hiroshima during World War II. And I wonder what the evolution is. Are we moving towards a place where that is becoming an unthinkable thing to have done instead of a... Because I think Americans have always been pretty defensive over, given the circumstances, there was no choice. And I wonder, are you alluding to that being reconsidered?
Oh, definitely. Oh, I think historians are pondering whether or not there was no choice. You see, we didn't have an internet. We didn't have as many investigative reporters in those days. And there was a certain acceptance back in that homogenized media world of a status quo that we all just bought into. And the story, the narrative, to use a word, was that the only way we were going to get Japan to surrender would be to do something that absolutely is a knockout punch, because if we did an invasion of Japan, X number of American lives would be lost. So Harry Truman had to make the decision, and he made the decision to drop the bomb. As a result, he's a hero for saving American lives. And that was the story that really has been the prevailing narrative. And I'm not saying that it's wrong. What I'm saying is, it's not the only narrative. It's not the
only... Yeah, what's the alternative argument that's most compelling in your mind? Because I think most people maybe haven't heard it.
The good question. The alternative argument is that maybe there were other ways of dealing with Japan. Maybe they would have surrendered. Maybe diplomacy would have worked. Maybe we only had to drop one bomb on a city, not two. Nagasaki was also bombed. There are a lot of alternative narratives. Maybe, you know, we shouldn't be at war at all anyway. I mean, I'm not saying that because obviously we live in the real world, and the real world is there are dangerous people and you have to sometimes fight to survive or fight for your principles. But it was such a dramatic and such a final solution, if you will, to a situation that you can't just say, okay, hey, we won, we did it, we showed them. I mean, babies, women, children, civilians were you know, incinerated. It's got to be troubling, even if it led to victory. Just the idea that it wasn't troubling. It was accepted as what we had to do because we have to do whatever we have to do to maintain our way of life. How many times do you hear people say that, our way of life?
Yes.
I'm dangerously close to people saying, oh, you're un-American, you don't like it. No, I love our way of life. But what aspects of our way of life are so important that we, to protect it, consider it as morally acceptable to wipe
kill
out
thousands and thousands of people? All right, we're going to break for news. Michael Harrison, stay with us. More coming up on WTIC.
186,000.
It is possible for us to get lost, and I guess in retrospect, we will look back at this period as one in which we've been so in love with our toys that we haven't noticed so much. We haven't been attentive so much to the to the more spiritual side. But we're ready, I think. I mean, at least to consider it. Michael, you there? Oh, wait a sec.
How,
I clicked out. There
I
you
wonder,
go.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah.
I wonder how we're going to look back at 2020 as the years go by. I wonder whether we'll look back at this as a better experience than it feels like as we're going through it. Because you often hear people say, oh, is this the worst year? And, you know, in many ways, it obviously is a terrible, terrible year. But I wonder what history is going to do to it. I wonder, you know, if people will look back at it and say, wow, that was quite an experience. Remember, we were all in our houses for months and we were wearing masks and, you know, people telling their children about it and going, no, you didn't go through that, did you? Really? You know, I wonder.
Oh, I think everything is up for negotiation and debate because, you know, to me, you shouldn't be evaluating whether it's a good year or not. We shouldn't be evaluating it based on what kind of hard times we went through, because there should be hard times virtually all the time in some communities or another. The key is how do we respond? And that's a reflection of how prepared we are and how generous in spirit and practically generous we are. And I think that really we don't know how we'll look at 2020 because we're so far from being at that point where we can evaluate whether our response was a capable one or not.
Yes, no question about it. But it's interesting, you know, sometimes one year blurs into another. Like, you know, the difference between 2003 and 2004, or, you know, 2015 and 2016. They just blur together. Other years really stand out. And, you know, 1776, that's a year, has a lot more ring to it than 1777 or 1775.
Yes.
So there's no question, first of all, the whole symmetry of 2020, the whole allusion to, you know, clear vision, 2020 vision, you know, that you see things clearly. I think that the year 2020 will be remembered by everybody who is experiencing it, whether they're 7 years old or they're 70 years old, going forward for the rest of their lives. I think it's one of those years that says not all years are the same. There are milestones. There are situations in which we have a common collective memory. And this year is certainly one of them.
Yes, but it depends on what happens in 2021. And it could easily be kidnapped, 2020, by next year or thereafter, especially with the virus. I frequently am watching the media coverage, newspaper, TV, whatever, of the virus, and it's within a context that's very narrow that we judge it. We don't judge it, for example. We're not looking and saying, are we making a big mistake? Which I think we should always be challenging the assumptions we're making. We assumed culturally that the way to deal with this was not to let it flow through the population and cause a lot of people to build up resistance, that it was better to hide everybody. And I wonder if what the chances are that in another year we'll be thinking, oh, man, we should have been doing it that way. Or the states right now that are getting the southern states that are getting the big hit in California, well, there's northern states, too. There's all kinds who are getting this hit that is way after the initial hit that New England and New York got. And we think of them as maybe having done something wrong or them as suffering right now. But maybe they're getting the best of this because it's soaking through more young people. And they're going to build up a herd immunity that maybe we haven't achieved in Connecticut or other states. And I just think there's a lot to this narrative that hasn't been written yet for us to wait and see in order to have a sense of how it plays out historically.
Well, I guess it's going to come down to making a judgment call as to how many lives are acceptable to be lost for some type of a greater good. Now, that brings us back to our discussion about Hiroshima You know, same thing.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
I mean, if we didn't do it, look at all the lives that would be lost. Okay, and therefore it was a good thing that we, you know, lost X number of lives because it would have been more. And what you're saying is that, you know, let's just lose whatever lives it takes. I'm not criticizing you. I'm just pointing it out objectively for a greater good that eventually we will overcome this thing. It's called sacrifice. And sacrifice can be quite a barbaric concept when you look at it for what it really is. I don't know if we have that choice. In the end, it may turn out that the herd immunity, if such a thing is possible with this particular bug, it may turn out well in the end, but I don't think that's the kind of choice you could make that, okay, we're going to lose about 250,000 people, but most of them are old and most of them are sick anyway, and that will achieve a herd immunity so that going forward after that, we're going to be okay. Think about that. I mean, that's not the kind of decision you make of, should I spend $100 on this fabulous suit or dress, or should I spend it on, food for my kids?
Well, I'm thinking more that it's too complicated for us to know which of the paths we could have taken would come with fewer deaths. I believe we have elevated deaths in the elderly community because we didn't focus on the elderly community as being the hypersensitive place, and had we protected them more and left younger people to their own devices, that we might not have saved more elderly. So I just think there's a lot of unknowns. And like you say, we really don't understand the disease yet. And a lot of the assumptions that we made about how to respond to it were based on some idea that we knew what it was based on other viruses we've dealt with. And in a lot of ways, it's very different and requires us learning new protocols and new responses. It's been a fascinating disease. But I'm thinking that that you could map out these two and not be sure of which the results are until you're into the second year or third year where you can see how some of the guesses play out.
How long do you think this is going to be a major issue, just if you had a guess?
I would say another year.
Another year, yeah. I remember when this first started, we were thinking in terms of weeks. And how do I know? Because I was involved, and I'm involved in an industry where we have events. And, mm-hmm. I wasn't the only one. My company wasn't the only one putting on a convention. There were many. And at first we were postponing. Then the postpone word turned into the cancel word. And do you realize how many weddings, bar mitzvahs, school graduations, all kinds of events, not to mention the Major League Baseball season, were messed up? And people were thinking, all right, maybe by June we'll be okay. Maybe by August. Now, maybe another year.
If you look at what's going on right now along with those decisions, people trying to decide whether to go back to school, colleges and universities that have been full speed ahead trying to make sure they were opening this fall are now chickening out and starting to change their minds a little bit. It's a really difficult thing, especially after you've shut things down, after you turn off the engines, the machinery of modernity and the engine of an economy, and then you say, okay, let's get it going again. Well, that's a hard thing. There's a lot
very
of
difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of inertia there that says, you're not going anywhere.
No, you're absolutely right. And I guess that comes under the heading of we're still in the unknown. We still don't have answers to these things, and we're still in the forest, you know. We don't know how big a forest it is. We don't know how big this universe that we're in happens to be and where the boundaries are, and when we eventually will get out of it. We might be so changed by it that when we get out of it, we're not going to want to give up some of the new things we did to compensate for it, because they're going to become the new normal. You know,
we might not want to go back to having professional sports.
We might not want to go to a stadium that has 60,000 people in it. We might not want to be in a crowd where you're rubbing up against strangers in situations mm-hmm. that we've all found ourselves in. If you're in a subway, you're waiting for a plane, you're in a theater and the show is over and now you're standing in the aisle waiting to get out, or you're standing in the aisle of an airplane waiting to get to the door, and there's somebody right in front of you, right behind you. You walk into a crowded elevator. There are so many things that we just may never want to do again,
yeah,
because we're cognizant of the ramifications of having such close physical contact with strangers.
Although, you know, my guess is that we are, once we're past this particular virus and the vulnerability of having a plague out there, once we're beyond it, that the public health officials will be telling us we have to start mixing. I believe now that we are designed to be, because we throw so much spittle out into the air when we breathe, and because stuff is coming out of our lungs and being shared, which we never knew before. And now we know we're in danger because of COVID, because of these little globules of liquid coming up out of our lungs carrying a potential deadly virus. That once the potential deadly virus is gone, I think we have to confront that we are designed to be sharing these pieces of ourselves, and that's how we keep each other's immune systems up to snuff, by making sure these little particles of hazardous material are going inside of us so we can build up our resistance. So the wrong response might be the one that seems most obvious, and that is refuse to go back into those big crowds.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but that's just one slice of the pie. I mean, that's just one angle. You're making it sound as if herd immunity is the only way to fight disease, and that's a good thing and a natural thing. The point is there'll be new diseases, and there are going to be new things that come from spittle or from eating ill-advised creatures, you know, animals that we should not be eating. That's a whole issue that's part of this story that's going to really come to light after we're past the initial crisis. In other words, how much herd immunity can we bear? Okay, we finally get over, we have this COVID-19. What about COVID-22 and COVID-25?
Well, it's possible. You're right. We could have a run of these things. We could be in a 25-year period where there's 13 of them that develop,
right,
or something. But
so we'll kill the entire herd to achieve herd immunity.
Well, that would do it.
There's diminishing returns to your theory. It's a limited theory. I was saying that I find it very stimulating doing this, and it definitely is a high wire act, because much of the stuff that we talk about is stuff that you think about in the back of your mind, but you don't always fully think it out or explore it or even have time to talk about it. And it all relates to current events. It all relates to the news. It's just as a different angles on it. And I think it's kind of productive and fun to do it. So thank you for the opportunity to have these conversations with you. Obviously, enough listeners enjoy it that we're not, you know, imposing on them. But the fact we've been doing this for a number of years is kind of amazing to me, and in many ways gratifying. So thank you.
You just made me think of something that I think is worth sharing. And that is, I was having a conversation with my mother, who's 91, a couple of months ago, and very sharp still intellectually. It seems like people either lose it first physically or lose it first intellectually. And she's struggling more physically than in terms of her lucidity. Anyway, we were having a conversation, and it turned into this deep conversation about, you know, how you look at the world on a personal level. And I remember thinking, I've never had that conversation with my mother before. Why is that I've never heard the way she thinks? I've never heard before how she looks at deep issues. And I think it's weird about us. We don't reveal those things to each other. It's one of those things I want to do on the air. I want to be able to talk about things that people don't hear said but might think to themselves. Those are the best parts of us, and we keep them private. I don't get that.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah, you want to really get down. You really want to get down with people.
I do. Why do we keep our brilliance, our most brilliant parts of ourselves, private? Let's share it.
Well, couple of reasons. One, there's a thing called too much information. Some people just don't give a damn, and they consider it an imposition for you to bring them too closely into your inner mind. They just don't want to hear about it.
But it's not like personal stuff. It's not TMI in that way. It's just how do you process, how do you put these things into logical place so that you can advance your way through the world?
I hear you. Do you think that your mother has always had this level of interest and you just didn't tap it? Was it her doing that she finally got down with you? Was it something you did to bring her out?
I think it was just a moment where maybe I asked the right question and she was ready. You know, she was raised by a woman who came over at 7 years old with her sister alone on a ship from Russia when, you know, back in the early 1900s. And I think she wasn't raised by people who dealt in those kinds of thoughts or communicated their views of the world. They were too busy fighting to survive.
That's right. That goes back to what we talked about earlier. They were too busy tilling the fields and sewing their clothes and hunting for their food and fighting off far more diseases than we have.
Yes, they struggled more, and we have the luxury of these things. Anyway, that's one of the things I like with you is that I can throw out any subject, and you seem to know more about it than I do, and that's always gratifying to
I can't just let you say that without turning red and saying there's plenty of things you know that I don't have a clue about either. So it only means that you're a gracious host, and you give me, who is always in the role of the guest, the opportunity to shine.
The news starts.
O'Reilly.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.